return now on today's Underreported from what might seem to some as the failed state of New York to failed states all over the world. Foreign Policy Magazine, in conjunction with the Fund for Peace, compiles an annual report on the world's most at-risk, lawless, and generally dysfunctional countries, and this year's list can be found in the current issue of the magazine. Joining me now is Elizabeth Dickinson, the assistant editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. She helped compile this year's Failed State Index, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. My pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
How does the magazine define failed state?
Well, what the way that the index works is by looking at a number of indicators. There are 12 indicators, anything from number of refugees in the country to the economic decline of a country to the human rights record of a country. Now, the Fund for Peace gathers this data throughout the year, and it's compiled into the list that we publish in this current issue.
Compared to last year's index, is the world in worse shape?
It is, actually. That's one of the most interesting findings of this year's index, is that in nearly every indicator, and remember, there are 12 of these indicators, the scores rose, which means they got worse. That tells us this was a really hard year for the world's most fragile states. Some of the reasons that we can cite looking into this are, first of all, the high oil prices of the first half of the year and the food crisis that followed. You remember that commodity prices, food, fuel, everything really put a crunch on the poorest households who were already at the margins of financing their existence.
But many of the nations listed in the index of failed states lacked advanced banking sectors to begin with. So what's been dragging them under?
That's right. Well, the financial crisis, we'll see, I think, that more of this year as opposed to last year. The way that that's going to affect some of these states is sort of the trickle-down effect. As you mentioned, most of those countries are slightly less connected to the international banking sector. But where it is going to hurt is in two places. First of all, you're going to see investment just disappear from places, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, where some of the riskier money had gone. You're also going to see that despite the drop in oil prices, food prices have remained relatively high. So in addition to the overall economic decline that we're seeing worldwide, you still have these high prices that are really putting a crunch on households.
And sub-Saharan Africa is where a number of these failed states are located. Somalia topped the list this year again. Now, is this the most consistently dysfunctional country in the world?
In the last few years, it has been. And I think what you see there is, you know, it's really the culmination of a number of years of conflict. Somalia is significantly higher in many of the indicators. But having said that, there's a number of states who have been at the top of this index and remain in the top for the last few years. Sudan is one that's made an appearance in the top 10 over and over again. Zimbabwe is another. And in fact, Iraq has made a top appearance, hitting second place just last year. Now, it's improved since then, but what this tells us is that being a failed state is a very sticky position to be in. It's very hard to get out of these situations, even though there have been some cases of improvement.
Well, the UN-backed government of Somalia has been fighting two allied militant Islamic groups. How much of the country do the insurgents control?
It's not exactly clear. One of the hardest things when we're talking about Somalia is simply the fact that Western reporters, or local press for that matter, have a very difficult time reporting or even being in the country. What we're hearing, though, from what we do know on the ground from the UN, from the government reports, is that the transitional government, as you mentioned, backed by the UN, probably controls just, if at most, a few blocks of the city's capital, in addition to a few strongholds throughout the countryside. It's really a weak government. They've never really had a coherent army. And to be honest, they're simply outgunned.
The index quotes a report from the West Point Combating Terrorism Center that found that Somalia was too failed even for al-Qaeda to operate out of. I would think that a group like al-Qaeda would thrive in a place like Somalia.
Well, that report was a couple years old, and I think especially in recent months since this data was compiled, we've seen evidence that that might not in fact be the case. You know, my sense is that there really is a potential there, and, you know, we're basically everyone's waiting with bated breath to see if this really happens. There have been reports, especially in recent weeks, about an influx of foreign fighters coming into Somalia, heeding the call of some of the local leaders there. Certainly, the Islamist movement there is gaining momentum.
The African Union has a UN-backed peacekeeping mission in the country, and last month President Obama won a UN waiver to send 40 tons of weapons to Somalia to prop up the fledgling government. So do you think, do you have a sense that the world is at least paying attention to the country?
Well, certainly Somalia has caught everyone's attention. I'm afraid personally I have to be a little bit more pessimistic. The African Union peacekeeping force you mentioned is desperately outgunned. If the government is outgunned, the AU force is even struggling even further. They have not nearly as many troops as were mandated. They've struggled with supplies, and many of the forces on ground have threatened to pull out as conditions deteriorate. The weapons that have gone into Somalia from the United States government, that's the logistics of that are still very unclear. It's not clear where they're going, and particularly since there isn't a coherent government army, we're not really sure where those guns are going. Where you are seeing momentum is towards discussion of sending a bulked up UN peacekeeping force to back the African Union one there. Now, there's been discussion in the Security Council of that so far, but again, you know, countries like the United States are very reticent to jump into that simply because Somalia is there at number one, very daunting situation, and really, where do you start?
And it borders on two states that also haven't been in such good shape, Ethiopia and Yemen. Is there a regional aspect to this failed state story?
There absolutely is, and Yemen is the perfect example. One of the biggest destabilizers in Yemen right now is precisely that, is its location. The country has seen an influx of refugees coming out of Somalia. Now, whether or not those are tied to the insurgency is really unclear, but Yemen is also situated near Saudi Arabia, and it has become the sort of the secondary home of Saudi Arabia's al-Qaeda. One analyst told me that when you get in trouble in Saudi Arabia, you run to Yemen. Why? Because Yemen doesn't have the apparatus, the infrastructure, and frankly, the government capacity to deal with them in the same way that Saudi Arabia would. So yes, there's definitely a regional aspect here. And what we've seen is that conflicts can definitely travel over borders, you know, whether that means through people, whether that means simply through politics, it has a tendency to spread.
And what is the Yemeni government's primary source of income?
It happens to be oil. The perilous thing to say about that is that the oil is running out. I think about 80% of their budget right now is reliant on oil, and that oil will be gone in a matter of years.
Are there any major resources in Somalia?
In Somalia, there are not. That country's economy has mostly been barter economy for the last 18 years, during which it's been a civil war. To be honest, I think one of the biggest industries is probably piracy.
The index does make a distinction between Somalia and Somaliland, which is in its north. Why has Somaliland been able to maintain more stability than any of its neighbors?
Somaliland is a great example of what we talk about in the index about sub-state failure. This is the notion that even though a state might be failing, parts of it still might be quite functional. And so really branding something as a failed state is a little bit, it can be a little bit deceptive. So Somaliland has survived, you know, this 18 years of conflict by sort of separating itself. They have an autonomous government. They have a history of being separated from the parts of Somalia that are in turmoil. That's a colonial separation wherein the Somaliland was under British control and the rest of Somalia was under Italian control. So history sort of set them apart to begin with, but Somaliland has been very lucky in that its government has managed to create a few services. It's managed to maintain elections to look and feel something like a functional state.
I'm talking with Elizabeth Dickinson, assistant editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, which along with the Fund for Peace has compiled its annual report on the world's most at-risk, lawless, and generally dysfunctional countries in the current issue of Foreign Policy Magazine. Iran has jumped from 11 points up to 38th on your list. Did that happen even before the current political unrest?
It did. and all of this, all of the data that we're discussing right now sort of ends at January of this year. And so to see that Iran has already jumped 11 ranks in the index prior to what happened with the elections is really alarming. Now, the reason that you're seeing that is a couple of things, but it's all summed up in one word. It's economics. There's been rampant inflation. Unemployment is on the rise. You're seeing more and more young men in particular who are unemployed and who are eager to engage and to help support their families. At the same time, you're seeing a very strong security apparatus, one that can be repressive, as we've seen in recent months. All of that's culminated to push Iran up.
And oil prices have been dropping.
Exactly. So at the same time, you have the government really almost, you know, in crisis mode to deal with all of this.
Now, many of the nations on the index are also seeing a fresh influx of weapons. Where are these weapons coming from?
Well, they're coming from all over, and it depends what country we're talking about. But there is something interesting to mention. Now, on the global weapons market, two suppliers have a very significant share. Those are Russia and China. Those hold about a fourth, so about 25% of the global market. Among failed states, they hold about 40% of the market. That means that they're selling more to failed states than other sellers. What does this tell us? This tells us that they have less discretion about who they're selling to. And in addition, it tells us who the allies of the failed states are.
And those are just the official records. Do we have any idea of how much of the weapons sales are being done off the market?
We don't. And here's a great time to go back to Somalia. Somalia has had a weapons embargo for the last several years, but we're quite certain that weapons have been going into the country. So those transfers are not recorded in you know, the data that we've looked at. So we can be quite certain that the numbers are higher. One of the biggest problems that's actually emerging in the small arms trade is the licensing of weapons. That means that U.S.-designed, Russian-designed, Chinese-designed weapons are licensed to smaller producers, say in India, say in Saudi Arabia, say all over, and they're proliferating with less regulation. So you have a U.S.-quality weapon made in Pakistan or made elsewhere that ends up in one of these failed states without the same regulations.
Numerous reports, including one from the New American Foundation in 2008 and a 2006 congressional study, found that the United States remains a leading supplier of weapons to the developing world, but maybe the largest one. Why haven't you included that?
It is included, and I think that's a really good point that you bring up. I think it's very interesting to look in particular who the clients of U.S. arms dealers are. I mean, some of the biggest ones we see on this list are, for example, Colombia. Now, one of the reasons there is because the U.S. has an alliance with Colombia to help improve its military. So some of the arms sales that you're seeing there are going to the military. But this is definitely worth mentioning. And these are questions that are not raised enough.
And we've added or restored to the U.S. weapons client list the Democratic Republic of Congo, Liberia, Indonesia, Iraq, Afghanistan, India, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Uzbekistan. Some of these places are rather unstable, aren't they?
It's quite the list. And as I said, one of the things that this just tells us is that these questions aren't asked often enough. It's my sense that in general, it's my sense that the U.S. tends to sell to countries with which it has military alliances. Liberia, which you mentioned on the list, for example, there's a U.S. effort there to reconstruct the army after the Civil War. You know, other places, India, we saw Hillary Clinton there last week discussing some of the other cooperation with the U.S. So definitely the weapons follow the alliances. So looking behind the scenes at the weapons list tells us something very interesting about what's going on in politics.
Wouldn't failure in some of the countries on your list have much larger geopolitical implications than just the collapse of a country? For example, wouldn't the unraveling of Pakistan pose a greater global threat than the collapse of Zimbabwe, even though Zimbabwe looks like it's more likely to collapse? It's number two on your list.
It's true. Definitely with the geopolitical implications, Pakistan is at sort of the top of the list. In the last couple months, we've really seen that hit fever pitch here in Washington, where foreign policy is based. This is often referred to in the policy community here as the most dangerous place in the world. And like you said, the implications are clear. Should Pakistan really fail, this is a nuclear state. This is a state that has become a refuge for al-Qaeda. And should it fail, those two things might unfortunately coincide, where you see nuclear proliferation to these non-state entities, these terrorist bodies. Having said that, however, I honestly do think that the implications of any one of these states failing can't be understated. Zimbabwe is a great example here. If you look at Zimbabwe, it's a landlocked country. That means that if it fails, all of the six or seven states that surround it would face a massive influx of refugees, you know, a massive influx of arms, and quite frankly, the temptation is there to intervene.
Do representatives of any of these states respond to your list?
They did. We sought out many of the representatives of the top 20 countries this year, so I was able to sit down with ambassadors, with representatives at the embassy, and in one case, with the prime minister. We spoke with the prime minister of Zimbabwe.
And Morgan Tsvangirai also told you he isn't getting enough external support for his reform efforts.
He did. And I think his frustration really came through when we were speaking. Here's someone who has sacrificed really tremendously. He sacrificed really to work with a person who has literally tried to assassinate him. And though he's gone on this tour of world capitals in order to gain support for Zimbabwe's economic recovery, he's really struggled to find the economic support that he needs. That's not to say that there are not many problems remaining with Zimbabwe, and there are many questions to be asked about how and where aid might go, but certainly he expressed his frustration that the same international community that helped construct his government and convinced him to go into a power-sharing agreement with Robert Mugabe is unable or unwilling to support the result.
Have any countries come off the list?
There have. There have been a couple of success stories over the years. A great one that I love to talk about is Liberia. Liberia, which was in civil war up until 2005, had elections about a year later, elected one of the most admired presidents in West Africa, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who is a former World Bank official. And that country has dropped in the ranks significantly from its first days in 2005, 2006.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I've been talking with Elizabeth Dickinson, assistant editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, about the magazine's latest Failed States Index as part of our underreported series. And I should be a bit depressed, Elizabeth.
No, I think there's still lots of room for hope. There's many success stories, and while we don't see them on the list, the good news is that most of the world states are very stable.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is WNYC and WNYC.org, New York Public Radio. On tomorrow's show, guest host Julie Burstein talks with former Lehman Brothers Vice President Lawrence McDonald. He'll give us an insider's account of the company's collapse. Then filmmaker Jeffrey Smith and Dr. Henry Marsh, the subject of a new documentary called The English Surgeon. Also, Armando Iannucci discusses his new political satire, In the Loop. Plus, our latest Please Explain is all about pheromones. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Sherry Shen, Nicole Silbersack, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Tune in tomorrow.